The question is, wasn't there some sort of a social order or social notion of self-preservation whereby a society would ostracize a given individual from it in order to help preserve that society?
No, because see, in order to have the thing you're talking about, you have to have some sense of political unit that discuss that kind of self-preservation. What you're really talking about in those areas was a network of human obligations that went all over the place. You weren't necessarily even remotely interested in your next-door neighbor, but you were certainly interested in those people to whom you were tied by kinship or other kinds of very special relationships. Of course, there was a network in all over the earth of different kinds of social obligations and responsibilities. But there was nothing even remotely resembling a social unit of the kind of thing that we're accustomed to talking about. Social control was left entirely up to the muscles of the guy who could have put his phone on it, or what he could mobilize in terms of friends or relatives to accomplish his end. And the literature is full of classic examples of underactors.
Point Hope, just a fine example. The guy who got away with being a bully for 20 or 30 years, so he finally killed him.
These were the ways in which things were done. It doesn't say anything better or worse about people as human beings. I don't think that that's the issue. We're not talking about some genetic inferiority or anything like that. That's nothing to do with it. What we're talking about is the capacities that different people have developed through time to deal with different kinds of problems. And these capacities change relatively slowly. And what you see as the social ordering units that now exist in these communities are in fact something which was relatively recently imported and organized. It was certainly not imposed. I think you gotta, shake loose of words like that because they have implications that are very wrong. There was not any imposition or forceful imposition of any of these kinds of attitudes. They were rapidly and quickly grasped by local Eskimo communities because this was a way of doing something it's never been able to do before. Finally get rid of the guys that are killing you. So that was a very great difference. These were not imposed, but totally accepted, and very voluntarily accepted, such as Christianity was accepted for the same reason. It meant you didn't have to be afraid of the shaman.
I get the impression, though, that when we do go to the bush, that we are dealing with an entirely different subculture unit, and it depends which area you're going up to Barrow, if you're going out to Galena. And I just get the impression that we are, and I'm going to say imposing a standard on these people that they aren't ready to accept. And they, when they reach a decision, when a jury comes back with a verdict in the bush, they apply a local standard which is completely foreign to anything we recognize. You can trust a Fairbanks jury to generally follow the law. In the bush, I just saw a case, I didn't try it, come out of Fort Yukon. They took the case and did with it what they pleased.
Well, by the way, there are going to be tremendous differences between the way in which Eskimos and Indians respond to things. You're going to have a much more serious kind of split in Indian communities. But I don't think there's any need to go on with a lot of ethnographic detail. But I think your choice of words is extremely inappropriate because it lends itself to irresponsible assumptions about, the white oppression, nasty white races, doing it all those wonderful filths living out in villages. And that just ain't the way it really is.
I don't know that I feel that way about it, but I get the feeling they aren't all that much in favor of what we're bringing to them.
Neither were the people in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and when we passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. There were an awful lot of folks in Mississippi who felt they had a subcultural thing going for them that they wanted to go for them. I didn't remember any of the liberals that I know worrying too much about that at the time. And that was just as grossly illegal, and the things that you're talking about are grossly illegal activities in the bush that somehow or another we're supposed to accept now because these are people who are oppressed natives. We were not permitted to accept these things on the part of whites who lived in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1964. Standard is better, not two.
One standard is fine when you have a homogeneous society.
We've never had a homogeneous society.
Well,
this is the most heterogeneous society that has any kind of social.
Alaska certainly is.
No, the United States.
Yeah.
You're talking about the same kind of argument that you used to permit, that people tried to raise to allow Italians to continue producing alcohol during Prohibition. It's a subcultural thing. The thing is, we're nothing but subcultural units all over. It's not an argument that washes very well.
Do you think that then we should continue to try and bring this 20th century justice to the bush?
Yes, it's a far superior form of justice than anything available. You see, it's not a superior form of justice to be judged by your peers in whatever irrational mood they're in without any guide that they might have to an institutionalized set of laws that have been tested against reality for a couple of hundred generations. That's what you're talking about. Now, when you're talking about the mood of a particular community to confirm what it believes to be justice, you're taking a big risk as to whether or not it's going to be lynch justice or some other kind.
No, indeed. That is not better justice than the kind of thing we're bringing.
Not even remotely.
Well, in places like Point Barrow, they would indeed like to have Eskimo police officers, but the Eskimo police officers that have attempted the job are generally chased out of the business, and the white officers are not thought well of at all.
Yeah, but they don't get chased out of town.
No, but they're not respected, and nor is there any respect for that kind of justice in Barrow.
Yeah, but see, I'm not sure exactly what the communication is between these two ideas, but the fact is that you are supporting what I'm saying. If it is not possible at this point to find Eskimo men who would be tolerated as, who could stand the job of being a policeman in Barrow, it seems to be a very unfair thing to say to the people in Barrow, well, you're Eskimo, you ought to have an Eskimo policeman. If you can't put up with them, well, we'll just let you go on your own. That's racism in the worst kind. Those are American citizens. They have a right to the kind of protection that every other American citizen has. And if that means having people who are policemen from a different ethnic system, they're fine. I grew up in a German and Pole neighborhood, mostly Germans, Poles, and Russians. All our cops were Irish. I don't think it ever occurred to any of us there was something wrong with that.
Can you foresee any sort of a local rule system or a home rule system which would work, as opposed to...
Yes. I think it's in the way of evolving now, and I wouldn't even attempt to try to describe what it would be like, but I think it's in the way of evolving now, along the way that home rule systems are evolving in Alaska, in terms of the borough, what we do in interpreting what the borough means and what the unorganized borough means. These are in the process of evolution now. So yes, of course it's going to be home rule. It should be home rule. But that rule should be under law and within the constraints of American law.
I don't argue against that. I mean, I just find a certain friction in trying to take it, the law in the city, out to the bush and impose it. I mean, as a matter of fact, if you have a felony in the bush, quite often it is filed as a misdemeanor because nobody is going to uphold that level of
crime. Okay, but see,
crime.
That's what exactly what people in the bush want. They want more protection. I've never run into a single responsible person in any Native community I've been in, and that's something like 60 or 70 by now, who has ever told me they feel oppressed by the presence of state troopers. They're always upset that there aren't enough policemen. They're well aware of the extraordinary levels of violence that occur in these communities. These are not comfortable places to live now. They were not comfortable places to live 100 years ago. They were only comfortable places to live in from about 1900 to 1950. That was nice.
Well, just let me make the observation that I feel less satisfied with the job my office, the court system, the justice system is doing in the bush than I do in Fairbanks
for the same
level of crime.
Yes.
And there's a word for crime in the bush, a bush demeanor. In our office, because you cannot prove, for instance, rape in the bush, where social norms have evolved in a much different context than ours, where a 13-year-old girl, I mean, if you're talking of statutory rape, a 13-year-old girl may well have engaged in sexual activities numerous times, by perhaps members of her own family. And we're trying to impose our standard, our social norms, on a different cultural unit. And
not really. You see, there is such a thing as pathology, period. And it isn't related to culture. Cultural relativity is a useful concept for teaching kids in school. It gets them to think in terms of a broader set of perspectives of how to view the world. But in the reality of the real world, it doesn't mean much. There really is a difference between pathological communities and non-pathological communities. And anybody can tell it anywhere. No matter how many defenses somebody tries to raise to you for incest in a family, I don't think you're really impressed, nor is anybody, because all of the evidence we have everywhere in the world is that creates pathological conditions in the child, which come out in serious difficulties as the child grows up. Everyone knows that. I mean, cultural relativity is bullshit when it comes down to these kinds of things. And, the issue in terms of the Constitution, I think, is that, the point I tried to raise at the very beginning is undoubtedly the framers of the Constitution were faced with a difficulty, part of which I don't think they wanted to face head on, because it's an extremely uncomfortable one to face head on, that they had to deal with a substantial population whose quality and capacity to deal with the 20th century was limited and was going to remain limited for a long time. So certain pretenses had to be evolved. They were legitimate ways of trying to, they did their best.
I think we're approaching noon when we're supposed to break up. So I think Millard Ingram and Justice Rabinowitz had comments they wanted to make.
Yeah, I just had one question to the panel, or perhaps anybody else here. We've all discussed this article. Does anyone have any specific amendments that they would make to this article in the event that, say, a constitutional convention were called? I think everybody. So that's the only question I have.
Well, I think it's been brought out. Does the retention election work? And are you going to abolish the change the retention election and put more powers in the qualifications commission, which will annually review the work of the judges, rather than retention election, which doesn't seem to be working, according to some of the sentiments of the panel? That might be an area that possibly the judiciary article will be amended. But I'd like to just make a final remark for those of you who are taking this for credit. The American Bar Association appointed a prestigious panel that discussed the problems of court organization and came up with minimum standards. These are recommended standards for the states under our federal system as to court organization. And they studied the problem for 4 years, and I think it's quite a tribute to the founding fathers of the Alaska Constitution that after 4 years they came up with a document that parallels the Alaska Constitution, has everything in it. The only thing we don't have that they recommend as an ideal standard is a one-level trial court system. And I think that this is a study that's been approved by the American Bar Association 20 years after the convention here in Alaska.
Of course, that's where we're getting, actually, right here. So we now have a unified trial court in Anchorage. It isn't too big a step to making one court. We're talking about a superior court judge who's acting also as a district court judge at Bethel, for instance. Once again, that's not bad, that's good.
Another thing about the unified court is that it means that the judge who's handling so much of the tedium and boredom of a lot of the lower court work is also going to get an occasional shot at some of the interesting work of the superior court. Might make it a little easier to get applicants to handle the misdemeanor level.
I just have one
observation. Judge Bucklow?
I think we should hold on to retaining the retention election. I think it has the public, the people have a chance to participate, and I really think it has a salutary effect on public officials.
I
think
I agree.
My name's got to go on a ballot, and those people have to accept me. And I think that was a wise decision. Now, I only have one suggestion. I think a 10-year term for Justice Supreme Court is too long. But I think someday justice is going to be defeated at the polls because it just depends upon what the attitude of the public is. But a lot of voters will look at that 10-year term and just say, well, I don't know about giving this man a 10-year term. That's too long. And he'll vote no on it. And I think that the district court judges, superior court judges, and Supreme Court justices probably should maybe go on about every 6 years. And that'd be the only change. I'm not certain that I'd do that, but I'd certainly consider lesser terms for Justice Supreme Court and identical terms for the three levels of judges.
May I ask a question to Justice Rabinowitz briefly? I'm Sylvia Shorten, attorney. If we went to the one trial court system, wouldn't this clog up our appellate process, or would you look for an intermediate appellate court?
For the non-lawyers, we don't have a one-level trial court. That should be obvious to you. Secondly, with the growth of population, growth of attorneys, we are getting an increase in appeals, but the short answer is no. I don't think it would result in significantly more appeals than we have now. But I want to make one point clear, since we are taping this, I forgot this. I'm not in favor of abolition of the retention election. I'm just saying that from the comments on this panel, this looks like one area that might be subject to change in our judiciary article. I think with the work of the Judicial Council and their evaluation of the work of the judges and giving this information to the public, you're having a much more informed vote by the electorate on the judge who is running. And it all goes back to the question Peter Ashenbrenner asked, is the system weighted, overly weighted in favor of attorney control, elitist control of the whole system? And that's a profound philosophical question.
Well, I'd like to thank the panelists, and I'd also like to thank the delegates and the other people in the room who've made comments and asked useful and challenging questions. Thank you very much.